welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden age. Mark LeVonier, your host for this hour of true history. Later on, we hear 1896 profiled, and that was the year and the cavalcade of America. But first, it's The Curtain of Time, a syndicated episode from April 21st, 1949, bringing us the saga of the Shenandoah.
Of all the ships that sailed the seas and rivers during the Civil War, none had a more romantic and adventurous career than the Confederate raider Shenandoah. Her skipper, Captain James Waddell, made quite a name for himself, too. Waddell, fresh out of Annapolis, was at sea aboard the USS Saginaw when the war started. The young man was a native of North Carolina and carried his Southern sympathies with him. So as soon as the Saginaw docked for provisions, he resigned and headed south to join the Confederate Navy. After winning glory for himself at Mobile Bay, Drury's Bluff, and Charleston, he was sent to Liverpool, England, on a secret mission. There he met Commander Bullock, head of the Secret Service of the Confederacy. The espionage agent explained the situation to Waddell.
Captain, you were sent over here to take command of a raider to be used in sinking or capturing Union whaling vessels and merchant ships. I finally found a ship for you. She's an Indian merchant ship. Not a warship, so she'll have to be converted. She's crewless, too, and that adds to the problem. It is an infernal Foreign Enlistment Act which forbids any Britisher from enlisting in the service of a foreign power while still on British soil.
Bullock went on to explain that there were a few officers who were very anxious to get underway. Of course, they would need both courage and foolhardiness if this undermanned, underarmed ship should encounter a Yankee man of war. Waddell had only one reply. When do I sail, sir? A few nights after the interview, 20 men converged upon a dimly lit Liverpool pier and boarded the Laurel, a small, rusty coastwise steamer. When the last man was aboard, she disappeared into the darkness and fog that covered the Mersey River. Each of the men had a passenger ticket for Glasgow, and the hundreds of mysterious boxes and barrels aboard were consigned to the same port. But instead of heading northward toward Glasgow, the Laurel set a course south through the St. George's Channel toward the island of Madeira. Next day, Captain Waddell called the passengers into a conference.
Gentlemen, when you volunteered for this voyage, many of you didn't know what it was all about, except that you were promised some action and adventure. Well, we're on our way to the Bay of Funchal, Madeira, to a rendezvous with a ship that left London the same time we left Liverpool. This ship is the Sea King, a full-rigged three-master with auxiliary engines. All that I'm permitted to tell you is that she's under British registry now, but her captain has the authority to turn her over to us. Around midnight, a week later, the Laurel was riding at anchor in the Bay of Funchal. The moon came out from behind a cloud, and Waddell could make out the dark form of an approaching ship. She was under steam as she circled the Laurel, and Waddell felt a sudden surge of pride as he realized that he was looking upon his first command. Shortly after daybreak, Captain Waddell went aboard the Sea King and conferred with a British captain, Corbett.
You made good time, sir. When we're finished with the business at hand, I'd like your permission for use of the quarterdeck.
The two ships were lashed together, and the puzzled crew of both the Laurel and the Sea King watched a solemn group of men disappear below deck of the larger vessel. They were even more amazed to see these same men, the former passengers of the Laurel, appear on deck clad in the gray uniforms of the Confederate Navy. Captain Waddell mounted the quarterdeck.
Men, you knew me and my friends only as passengers bound for Glasgow. Actually, we're here to take command of the ship. This is now a Confederate raider, and I need men. We're at sea now, out of the jurisdiction of the Foreign Enlistment Act. I'll pay good wages and a good bonus to every man who wants to sail with me.
Some of the men, thinking of the adventure and the higher pay, cast their lots with the Confederacy. There was quite a ceremony as the British ensign was lowered and replaced with the stars and bars of the Confederate States of America. Waddell saluted smartly.
I name thee Shenandoah, the Confederate raider Shenandoah.
Eager hands rushed to transfer the cargo of the Laurel to the Shenandoah. Gun ports were cut, cannon uncrated and placed in position. At last she got underway, setting a course for the east coast of America. On the way, she encountered several Yankee merchant ships. Captain Waddell decided not to wait until he reached the Pacific whaling grounds to get into action. Some of the merchantmen he captured and sank after taking their crews aboard. Others he bonded and set free. During the month of January 1865, the Shenandoah reached Melbourne, Australia, and put in for coal, water, and repairs. Here she ran into her first real trouble. There was a crafty United States consul at Melbourne, and in spite of the Foreign Enlistment Act, which was in effect here, he bribed 18 of the Shenandoah sailors to desert. So the new warship left the harbor shorthanded. Until the next morning, Waddell had put over another of his schemes. 42 stowaways showed up in the mess room for breakfast and were immediately signed in the articles. Sometime later, Captain Waddell was in the Carolines, wrecking havoc among the whaling fleets and having a grand time of it. He came upon an Hawaiian trading schooner, and her captain told him that there were four New England whalers anchored in the harbor of Punapi. Naturally, Waddell was interested. And a week later, he stood off the island and planned an attack on the poor, unsuspecting whale chasers. One of his officers, a Scotsman, called him on deck. "Captain, there's a man coming alongside in a rowboat. I can't tell if he's a white man or a native, but he's sure a queer-looking geek." The rowboat pulled alongside the Shenandoah, and a lean, dark-bearded man in dirty whites climbed aboard and addressed the captain.
"Skipper, I'm Thomas Attuck, the pilot of this place. I hope you've no objections to having an escaped convict taken over, but you see, I'm the only man around here who can get you over the reef. The fee will be £5, payable now."
Captain Waddell engaged the pilot, who guided the ship skillfully over the reef and anchored her within gunshot of the whalers.
"Those whaling crews have been having quite a drinking bout ashore. I don't think they're in a proper mood or disposition for a fight."
It then occurred to Waddell that since the whalers were technically under the protection of the head man of the island, it would be a good idea to get the native king's permission before he started tossing cannonballs around the harbor. So he invited the king aboard, and with Pilot Harrick as interpreter, he explained the situation and offered an attractive bargain.
"The ships in your harbor belong to our enemy. With your permission, I shall capture them, turn the contents over to you, then sink them."
The king went ashore for a conference with his chiefs. There followed a period of tense waiting before the king returned with a decision. The whalers hadn't made themselves too popular with the natives, so Waddell could go ahead and sink them. That night he went to work on them. Before the Yankees knew what was going on, the Confederates and the natives had looted and burned the ships and taken the crews captive. This venture over, the Shenandoah cleared the reef with a morning tide and headed northward for the Bering Sea. Long before Captain Waddell reached the great whaling grounds of the Arctic, the Civil War was over. But neither he nor his future Yankee victims knew that. The Shenandoah was still on the prowl. 6 days after entering the Bering Sea, a lookout aloft called down to his mates on the deck, "Blubber floating off the starboard bow!" Floating blubber could only mean one thing. Whaling vessels were in the neighborhood. Waddell ordered his men to their stations and began searching for his quarry. Late in the afternoon, he came across three New Bedford whalers. One of them he knew to be the Abigail, for he knew her rake and rigging well. As he moved within hailing distance, he wondered if his old friend, Captain Noah Williams, was aboard. He reached for his megaphone and called out,
"Ahoy, the Abigail! Stand by for a visiting party!"
Captain Waddell lowered a boat, and a crew of his sailors rowed it alongside the Abigail's Jacob's Ladder. Some of the men on the Abigail were busy cutting up whales, blissfully unaware of the impending danger. Captain Williams greeted Waddell expansively.
"Well, soul horse and sea biscuits, if it's not Jimmy Waddell. I didn't know you turned whale. I thought you Southerners were game fishermen."
A few minutes later, the old Yankee skipper's smile had vanished, and so had his joy of seeing his old friend Waddell. Waddell revealed the identity of the Shenandoah and ordered the Abigail and her crew to surrender to the Confederate Navy. There was nothing Williams could do but oblige, growling and sputtering as he did.
"Doggone, Waddell, I'm a prisoner, all right, but I never thought I'd run across a rebel raider way up here. If I had, I'd have put some guns aboard and given you the fight of your life."
Waddell grinned as he turned to the old sea dog.
"Well, you see, the Confederacy has signed a treaty with the whales. We're up here to protect them against their mortal enemies."
The Abigail and the other two ships were captured and burned. Then the Shenandoah moved still further north into the heart of the whaling grounds. There she really began to wreak havoc among the unarmed, unsuspecting whalers, at times sinking as many as 9 ships in one day. She destroyed millions of dollars worth of northern shipping in 1 week. At last, Captain Waddell could find no more prizes, so he turned about and headed southward. His mission had been accomplished. He had reached the coast of Mexico before he sighted another sail. She was the British bark, Barracuda, and Waddell went alongside to see if there was any news of the war. The master of the Barracuda called back.
The war, Captain, has been over for months.
Along with that announcement came the disheartening news that the entire Pacific fleet was on the hunt for the Shenandoah. When caught, her officers and men would hang. A rather unhappy predicament to be in. Waddell hurried to change the appearance of his vessel. He sealed the gun ports, gave her a coat of white paint, and struck a smokestack. Then he set out on a voyage around Cape Horn to England. The Shenandoah reached Liverpool and surrendered into the protection of the British Navy. This seemed to settle the doom of the brave ship. The United States ambassador claimed the ship and later sold her to the Sultan of Zanzibar as a coastal trading vessel. Waddell and his men returned to the States unmolested. She had sailed every ocean except the Antarctic. She was the only ship to carry the Confederate flag around the world even 6 months after the war was over. The last gun for the Southern cause was fired from her deck. She cruised almost 60,000 miles with no serious injury to herself nor to her men. She inflicted no loss of life and suffered none, and she never lost a chase. Such was the brave saga of the Shenandoah, a great ship that has gone to take her own niche in maritime history. Well, this period behind the curtain of time is over. This is Jeff Corey, thanking my writers Charles Crowder and Thurston Hoffman, and inviting you to join our next visit into the past, this time to witness the War on Chicago.
The Curtain of Time, on Tuned to Yesterday from April 21st, 1949, a syndicated broadcast. We move on now in this hour of true history with That Was the Year, where 1896 is profiled in a syndicated episode from 1935.
That was the year, recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. '96, that was the year. The annals of every year since time began hold the history of at least one event that by the sheer shock of its violent audacity remains long in the minds of men. Such an event was the memorable Jameson Raid, which had its culmination in the year 1896. Previously, for a long period of time, there had existed in South Africa bitter rivalry between the Boers of Dutch descent and the Uitlanders of British, Belgian, and French descent. The British settlers felt keenly that the Boers, under the leadership of President of the Transvaal Republic, Paul Kruger, by excessive taxes, high-handed control of elections, control of the courts, inadequate schools, and by any means at hand, were forcing British capital and British industry from the rich mineral lands of the Transvaal. It is July of 1896, in the Queen's Bench Division of the High Court of Justice in London, England.
Now, my lords, gentlemen of the jury, allow me to review briefly the sequence of plotting which led directly to this most unfortunate occurrence, the so-called Jameson Raid. Granted that within the hearts of these men there burned the unquenchable longing for a voice in the government of the Transvaal Republic in South Africa. For example, there was the ill-advised and inauspicious manifesto issued by Charles Lennox.
What do we want? We want, first, the establishment of this republic as a true republic. Second, a constitution which shall be framed by competent persons selected by representatives of the whole people. Third, an equitable franchise law and fair representation. Fourth, equality of the Dutch and English languages. Fifth, responsibility of the legislature to the heads of the great departments. Sixth, removal of religious disabilities. Seventh, independence of the courts of justice. Eighth, liberal and comprehensive education. Ninth, efficient civil service with adequate provision for pay and pension. Tenth, free trade in South African products. That is what we want.
That, my lords, was the thin spark which touched off this whole affair. Next, we know that last year, Dr. Jameson and Her Majesty's own premier in Cape Colony, Cecil Rhodes...
But, Cecil, we must have action, and we need your help.
Very well, Jim. I shall stand with you.
Good. Now, here are the plans. I shall gather a force of about 800 men at the Transvaal border.
And now, my lord,
I shall remain until
gentlemen,
I...
we have also presented into evidence the deciphered secret messages sent between certain parties to this conspiracy.
December 23rd, 1895, to Dr. Jameson, Fitzhenny. Company will be floated next Saturday, 12 o'clock night. They very anxious you must not start before Saturday night and secure telegraph silence. We suspect Transvaal getting away slightly. Harris, Cape Town.
What does Harris mean? Must not start before Saturday night. We're ready to start now, and by gad, we're going to start. This cause must not be lost.
And now, we know that Dr. Jameson did start. That word reached the Reform Committee in Johannesburg that Cecil Rhodes' brother, Colonel Francis Rhodes, distributed arms among the Uitlanders in that city. That Jameson and his so-called raiders were met and captured at Turnkop by the Boer forces. Shortly after, we all know Cecil Rhodes was found to have acted in a manner inconsistent with his duties as Prime Minister of Cape Colony and resigned his premiership in January of this year. If these men now facing English justice are not punished by the Crown for their part in this Jameson raid, the government will be guilty of rescinding their agreements with the President.
Late in the afternoon of July 28, 1896.
The prisoners will stand and face the court to receive sentence. You have all been found guilty by a jury of your peers on charges of violating the Foreign Enlistment Act, and it is now the duty of this court to mete out sentences commensurate with your guilt. Dr. Leander Starr Jameson, this court sentences you to 15 months' imprisonment in Holloway Prison without labor. Major John Willoughby, this court sentences you to 10...
And so ended the hapless Jameson raid. But the effects of this move were to be long-lasting, finding their culmination in the Boer War, the flight of Paul Kruger, and the complete and permanent control of Great Britain in the South African territories under question. And although Cecil John Rhodes had resigned as Premier of Cape Colony, he did not cease his tireless efforts in behalf of his beloved Queen and her government.
Sunday, August 23, 1896, Bulawayo, South Africa.
The chieftains and warriors of the belligerent Matabele tribes are gathered for a conference with the white chieftains. Finally, a horse gallops into view, comes to a halt near the natives. Cecil Rhodes dismounts, strides to the most befeathered of the Matabele chiefs.
Sekumbo, my brother, I greet you.
White Bwana Rhodes Mooka, I greet you. You carry gun?
No, Sekumbo, I am unarmed. I come to you and your warriors to tell you you must not fight your English brothers.
We make peace with condition.
Yes? And what is the condition, Sekumbo?
You must stay here.
I?
You must stay here, South Africa. Watch over Sekumbo and his warriors.
Yes, Sekumbo. I'll not leave you. I shall remain in South Africa.
Good. Then we lay down gun and assegai. Basi! Basi! How? Basi! Now, Sekumbo and warrior make peace.
Thank you, Sekumbo. This sort of thing is enough to make life worth living.
...1896. That was the year.
Moscow, Russia, May 26. In the awesome, hushed atmosphere of the Cathedral of the Assumption, in a small anteroom stand two gorgeously robed figures, Nicholas Alexandrovich Romanov and his wife, Alexandra Feorovna.
Nicholas, we shall soon be Tsar and Tsarina of all the Russias.
Yes.
What worries you, Nicholas? All this day you have been suffering.
Alexandra, I am not prepared for this great task.
Oh, why do you say that? You are the most regal
no,
of all.
No, a monarch must do more than wear uniforms. He must shoulder more than a robe of ermine. There have been ill omens today.
Omens?
Yes, signs which bode ill for my reign. In the festival celebrating our coronation, 3,000 of my subjects were trampled to death. Festival. And just now, as we came to the steps of the cathedral, the imperial chain fell from my breast. Mark you, Alexandra. Mark what I say. The reign of Nicholas II is doomed.
Your Imperial Majesties, everything is ready.
Oh, yes, yes, thank you. Come, Alexandra. The death march is being played for us.
Twenty-two years later, in the torch-lit cellar of a house in Tobolsk, Nicholas Alexandrovich, last of the Romanov dynasty, which had occupied a trembling throne for three centuries, his empress and their five children, was shot to death by a Soviet commissar.
1896, that was the year
that Alfred Bernhard Nobel, creator of dynamite and smokeless powder, died on December 10, leaving a will establishing funds for annual prizes to be awarded under his name. One of these prizes, by Nobel's own words, is awarded each year
to the person who shall have most or best promoted the fraternity of nations and the abolition or diminution of standing armies and the formation and increase of peace congresses.
1896, that was the year
that from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from Canada to Mexico, gay citizens of the U.S. were tripping a fast waltz to the 3-4 tempo of...
That was the year on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated episode from 1935, featuring narration by a 21-year-old Gerald Moore, who at that time was on Broadway appearing as a gangster, alongside Humphrey Bogart, Joan Alexander, and Leslie Howard in The Petrified Forest. He would soon become one of radio's busiest actors, starring in programs like The Whistler, The Lux Radio Theater, and one of his greater radio triumphs as the lead in The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. We wrap now with an episode of The Cavalcade of America called The Wizards of Whiting, the story of petroleum cracking, next on NBC from October 17th, 1950.
The DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware.
makers of better things for better living through chemistry, presents the Cavalcade of America. Tonight's stars, Lee Bowman and Ralph Bellamy. Tonight's DuPont Cavalcade, starring Ralph Bellamy as Dr. William Burton and Lee Bowman as Dr. Robert Humphreys, is called Wizards of Whiting, a true story of two men of courage and conviction. It begins in 1909 in Whiting, Indiana, the home of Dr. Robert Humphreys, chief chemist of the Standard Oil Company.
All right now, Claude. Say ah.
Ah.
Again.
Ah.
Well, that's fine.
Doc, tomorrow can I go fishing? Dad said we were going. It's the first time in such a long while.
I'm afraid not, young man. You're going to be in bed tomorrow, and for quite a few tomorrows after that.
Aw, gee.
Well, it'll be some other time, Claude.
It's just my rotten luck.
You'll have plenty of time for fishing. First job, though, is to get well.
Yes, sir.
I'll see you tomorrow.
I'd rather see a fish.
Claude.
I'm sorry.
Oh, Bob. Oh, I'm glad you're home early.
Hello, dear. Dr. Winslow. Someone sick around here?
Oh, it's Claude. He came home from school with a fever.
Just the beginning of a cold. Nothing to worry about. Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Doctor.
Goodbye, Doctor. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, not at all, not at all. Oh, don't bother. I'll find my way out.
Well, that's tough luck, Claude. Don't worry about it, though. We'll go fishing next week.
Yes, it is bad luck, honey.
Yeah, Whiting luck.
Whiting luck?
It's typical of all that's happened to us ever since we came to Whiting. One bad break after another. I knew it was wrong the day we first landed here.
Oh, Whiting's all right.
All right? Why, it's nothing but an oil refinery stuck out on the sand dunes. I'm sick of it. I want to get back to Virginia, to breathe clean air again. And why shouldn't we go? What's to be gained by staying here?
You've done very well here, Bob. You've been promoted to chief chemist, head of the department.
Head of the department? The department that does what? Have we done one solid, clean job of petroleum research? In 9 years, what have we done? Analyzed greases, worked on a wax paper drinking cup, a metal match of absolutely no practical use. How does that sound for 9 years of petroleum research? And do you think it'll be any better 9 years from now? Because it won't.
Oh, Bob. What is it you want to do?
I want to get out. Get away.
Oh, darling.
My mind's made up, Adelaide. We're going home. To Virginia. I'll see Dr. Burton tomorrow. I'm going to resign.
So, your resignation.
That's right, Dr. Burton, my resignation.
Well? It's a nice document, neatly typed.
I'm dead serious about this.
I'm sure you are, Bob. I've never known you to be anything but serious. Too serious sometimes. You've got to learn to relax, take things a little easier.
Yeah, that's exactly what I intend to do in Virginia.
I can't stop you, Bob. Wouldn't if I could. But it's a shame.
Why? Any chemist could do what I've been doing in the laboratory. You don't need a man with a Ph.D. to run routine analysis jobs.
That's right, I don't. I didn't need a Ph.D. 9 years ago when I called you here to Whiting. But I wanted a top chemist. I wanted him in the plant. I wanted to prove that a Ph.D. could do a job in industry. 10 years ago, when I came here to Whiting, I walked in. I remember it as if it were yesterday. When I walked in the first day, the plant superintendent looked me up and down and said, "Who are you?" "I'm your new chemist," says I. "Chemist," he says. "Well, if you're a chemist, where's your toolkit?"
What's the point?
Just this. 10 years ago, a man with a college degree in chemistry was a freak in this business. Even today, we chemists aren't quite accepted in the plant. Well, I believe that sooner or later, the petroleum industry will stand or fall on the basis of how much we chemists can learn about this grimy, slimy, evil-smelling stuff called petroleum.
Oh, that's just my point. I accepted your offer with Standard Oil because I believed it would give me an opportunity to do some real, basic, solid petroleum research. And I haven't had it.
Bob, in your rush down here to hand in your resignation, you didn't by any chance stop to buy yourself a morning paper, did you?
No, I didn't.
There's a news item from Detroit. Ever hear of Henry Ford?
He makes motor cars.
That's right. He's just announced that he's standardized his Model T. He's going into mass production. Here's what he says. "I will make a motor car for the multitude."
How many do you figure Henry Ford can sell?
The story is that he'll produce about 20,000 this year alone. Bob, by the end of next year, there's going to be over 500,000 motor cars on the roads. And that figure will double and double again in 5 years. There's only one thing that'll hold back the automobile.
Fuel.
That's right, fuel. Gasoline.
It's going to be pretty hard fueling 20,000 automobiles with the amount of gasoline available.
Hard? Let's say it's impossible. Bob, someone, somewhere, has to find out how to get more gasoline out of crude petroleum. Our best techniques today give us a gasoline yield of only 18%. It's not near enough.
Well, the only way to get more is to try to convert some of the heavier oil fractions into gasoline.
That's right.
How?
Bob, you've been begging for this. Now here's your chance.
What?
That's right.
Well, now, wait a minute. I want to make sure that I have this exactly right. Are you assigning me the job of developing a method of increasing the gasoline yield from crude petroleum?
That's right.
A full-scale research project?
By all means. Bob, I'm writing you a blank check. I have some ideas myself. You might start by trying heat and pressure and selected charging stocks.
Hmm.
Get whatever you need. Do whatever you believe needs doing. I'll have to clear the project with Buck Ross at the plant, but you can count on me. I'll work with you and for you. How does that sound?
Like music. Sweet and beautiful music.
What about your resignation?
Forget it. Tear it up.
Carry me back to old Virginny. That's where... Mom!
Yes, Claude?
Mom, what'll I do with my ice skates?
With your ice skates?
Yeah. Well, I guess I can give them away.
But why should you?
Well, what'll I need with ice skates in Virginia? That's the South.
Well, darling, it's not that far south. Oh, here's Dad now.
Hello. Where's everybody?
In here.
Hello, Claude. How are you feeling?
Much better, Dad.
Oh, that's swell. Well, what's going on, Adelaide? Did a hurricane hit the living room?
Almost. I'm packing.
Unpacking.
Oh?
Yeah. We're sticking.
What happened, Bob?
Oh, something just wonderful, darling. A new project, really new. Exciting.
What is it?
Research. We're going to try to find some way to increase the gasoline yield from crude petroleum.
Oh, well, just what does that mean, Bob?
It means that at last I'll have the chance to do what I want to do. Work in basic research. Pure research.
But I don't understand, Bob. Isn't there just so much gasoline in petroleum, just a certain percentage? If that's all there is, how can you get any more?
Well, look, Adelaide, it's easy to understand. Crude petroleum is made up of a number of different oils, fractions, we call them.
Mm-hmm.
Gasoline is one of the lightest fractions. Now, our idea is to take some of the heavier oils and try to make gasoline out of them.
How?
By heat and pressure. Break up the heavy molecules into lighter ones.
Oh, Bob, won't that be dangerous? Can't the oil explode?
Don't worry, honey. There's no danger at all. Oh, I can't tell you what a lift this has given me. I feel like a new individual, someone going someplace.
I feel just the opposite, like someone going no place. Oh. Well, I guess I don't have to worry about my ice skates after all.
Oh, Claude. Schultz. More heat under those pipes. We need a hotter fire.
The pipes will burst.
Hey, Rogers.
Yes, sir?
Did you check the results of the last run?
Yes, I've got the figures.
Well?
No luck. Gasoline percentage was about 18% and of pretty poor quality.
Turn it off, Schultz. It's no use.
Good.
Well, it's pretty obvious we're not getting anywhere by passing oil through these heated tubes. And it just doesn't work out.
Nothing seems to work out.
I can't understand it. Theoretically, we're sound. The application of extreme heat should crack the high boiling point fractions of petroleum into low boiling point fractions. Gasoline is made up of low boiling fractions. We should be able to crack it out.
Well, the trouble is, the oil distills off before cracking takes place.
Yeah, that's right. If we could only hold it in a still until it reaches the cracking point. Hold it in. Seal it in.
But how?
Well, there's only one way, by pressure.
You can't put oil under high heat and pressure.
Why not?
Well, that's obvious. Distillation of oil needs temperatures ranging as high as 600 to 780 degrees Fahrenheit. What would happen to the still when you get your oil that hot and subject it to pressure? The rivets will give way, your coke will form on the bottom, the still will blow on us.
How do you know?
Well, it's obvious.
Oh, nothing is obvious unless it's tried. Schultz.
Yes?
Schultz, you're a top still man.
The best, naturally.
I want you to have the boiler shop build me 100-gallon still. It'll be gas-fired and strong enough to take terrific pressure. Can you do it?
Build it? Yeah, that I can do. But run it? Well, that's something else again.
We'll worry about that later. Right now, let's get it built. What's our pressure, Rogers?
15 pounds.
Schultz, temperature reading?
500 degrees plus.
More heat.
Dr. Humphreys, please.
More heat.
All right, shut it down.
What's the matter here?
Dr. Humphreys, as plant superintendent, I'm ordering you to shut down that still and in a hurry.
Dr. Burton.
I'm sorry, Bob. You'll have to do what Ross says.
But I don't understand.
Shut off that boiler, Schultz.
I should say so, Mr. Ross.
Bob, I'm sorry. Ross here is in charge of the plant, and he says we'll have to call it quits.
Call it quits? Why, we've just started. At 5 pounds pressure, we got some cracking. Not much, but a little. At 10 pounds, we did better. Now we're at 15 pounds, and we're really getting results.
Yeah, you're getting results, all right. This whole plant's on the verge of shutting down.
But why?
Because the men know what you're doing, even if you don't. You're aiming to blast this plant into Lake Michigan, that's what.
Nothing has happened?
Oh, no, not yet, maybe. But plenty will happen if you keep on going. You can't heat oil under high temperature and pressure. Can't be done. The newest apprentice in the plant knows it can't be done. The men are quitting. I don't blame them.
Dr. Burton?
I'm sorry, Bob. Really sorry. But I'm in no position to overrule Ross. We'll have to suspend the project.
DuPont Cavalcade continues, starring Ralph Bellamy as Dr. William Burton and Lee Bowman as Dr. Robert Humphreys. It is the year 1912. Over 1 million automobiles are already on the road. But the whole future of this new and thriving industry is suddenly threatened by an ever-increasing gasoline shortage. In the refinery of the Standard Oil Company, Dr. Robert E. Humphreys, trying to solve the problem, has been forced to suspend his experiments because of the fear of explosion.
Oh, we haven't walked together in the evening like this in a long time, Bob.
Why am I so restless, Adelaide? Why do I always feel that I'm drifting?
Well, you didn't feel that way when you were working on your oil cracking experiment.
No, that was something solid, good. I had the feeling I was going somewhere.
Bob, I want you to leave me.
What?
Oh, just temporarily. I think maybe you need a rest, a change. There's that chemistry meeting at Wabash, Indiana.
Hmm.
Why don't you go?
Are you trying to get rid of me?
I certainly am.
Why?
Well, because I think it would do you a world of good. You always enjoy talking shop with other chemists, swapping ideas. Maybe you come back with some new information, something that'll give you another start.
Come with me.
Oh, I should say not. I get enough about chemistry from one man in my life. Oh, imagine having to listen to dozens.
Dr. Kentland?
That's right.
I'm not disturbing you, I hope.
Not at all. Sit down.
Go on with your lunch, please. I'm Humphreys of Standard Oil.
Oh, yes, I've heard of you. It's a pleasure to meet you. Have some coffee?
No, thank you. Dr. Kentland, I was in the audience at the panel you conducted this morning.
Huh?
As I understood what you said, you claimed to have distilled petroleum fractions in your laboratory, distilled them under pressure with steam up to 50 pounds.
That's right.
And no explosion.
I'm still here.
Well, how big a still do you use, Doctor?
Oh, naturally, only a small one. Very small, just a laboratory still.
Well, would it work on a larger scale? And do you think we might get even higher pressures without danger of explosion?
Well, that I can't say. But I have a suggestion.
Yes?
Build a bigger still. Run higher pressures. Find out.
But
the devil are you doing back at work, Bob? You're supposed to be on a vacation.
Yeah, I just got back. Dr. Burton, you've heard of Dr. Kentland.
Yes.
I met him in Wabash. He swears on a stack of Bibles that he's been able to distill petroleum fractions in his lab under steam to 50 pounds pressure.
Bob, listen.
50 pounds pressure and no explosion.
It's interesting.
It's a fact.
So it all gets back to where we started, heat and pressure.
It's the only way. We've got to give it another try.
We only have Kentland's word that he was able to work pressure up to 50 pounds, and then only with steam in a laboratory still.
Oh, he's a sound chemist.
Sure he is. But the fact remains that working with a large still without steam is a lot different from using his small laboratory still. For one thing, a small still can be made out of a solid sheet of steel, no seams. Any large still we use will have to have sheets riveted together. Will those seams stand up under high pressure?
I think they will.
Can you get men to work with you?
I'll get the men.
What about Ross?
Well, you'll have to take care of that.
It's a risk, Bob. An awful risk. But I don't know of anything worthwhile that's ever come along without someone taking a risk. The situation now is so critical, the gasoline shortage will soon be so bad that I don't think it's a matter of choice anymore. It must be done. It must be tried.
Then I've got your consent to go ahead with a large still?
Yes. Try it again. I'll back you up with Ross.
May I have your attention, please? We're going to fire up that still now, but before we do, let's get some things straight. First, let's be honest. There is a certain element of risk involved.
You're right, sir.
Yeah, and if any of you men want to quit, now's the time. No hard feelings, believe me, but I don't want anyone to walk off in the middle. Well, Schultz?
I'm a stubborn Dutchman. I'll stick.
Good. Attenson?
Me too.
Kwaliki?
Yep.
What about you, Rogers?
I'm ready.
All right. We're starting with 50 pounds pressure.
50 pounds?
And from that point, we keep going up.
Going up? How high up?
Until the rivets begin to bulge out of the seams.
That's nice.
Yeah, I thought you'd like it. Now, Attenson, you watch the pressure gauge. Kwaliki?
Yeah?
Keep your eyes glued to the thermometer. If pressure's getting too high, Attenson, it'll be your job to open the valve a fraction and equalize the pressure.
Right.
Kwaliki, keep calling your temperatures to Schultz. He'll tell you to adjust the heat up and down as needed.
Right.
Now, are we set? All right, Schultz, let's have some heat and let's get going.
Pressure, 30 pounds.
Heat,
590 degrees. Pressure, 45 pounds.
Heat,
690 degrees. Pressure, 60 pounds.
Heat,
720 degrees.
Dr. Humphreys, this thing has gone far enough, too far. Now, call it off.
I'm not calling anything off, Mr. Ross. Dr. Burton has agreed to let me go ahead.
Well, I phoned Burton in Chicago. He's on his way to the plant. We'll get this settled right now.
That's fine.
The men in the plant are getting panicky.
Well, there's no reason to get panicky. We're working along carefully, step by step.
You can't do it.
I am doing it and getting results.
Doc, you must be gone completely out of your mind.
Gentlemen.
Dr. Burton.
What was so urgent here, Ross?
You know what's happening here? Dr. Humphreys intends to bring that still up to 75 pounds pressure today.
Is that a fact, Bob?
It's a fact.
Think you'll get results?
I know I will. We're set to go.
Fine.
What? You're not going to let him go ahead any further, are you, Dr. Burton?
Let him do it. I'm not only going to let him do it, but I'm going to stick right here and help him.
Okay. Go ahead, then. Blow up the plant. But you'll have to take the responsibility.
All right, I'll take the responsibility. Come on, Bob. Let's get to work.
Pounds. 71. 72.
Temperature?
740 degrees.
More heat, Schultz. I want 750.
Yeah, 750.
Rogers, get ready to handle the valve for the runoff.
All ready.
74 pounds pressure. Building. Heat. More heat. 75 pounds.
Cracking point. Open the runoff valve.
Bob, look at the seams. They're on fire. The rivets will give way any minute.
Keep the pressure steady. Keep the heat going. Schultz, we've got to caulk the seams to stop those leaks.
Oh, the seams. Climb up on top of the steel? Not me.
Where are the caulking hammers?
Here.
I'll do it.
Bob, don't.
It's all right. I can do it. Just keep the steel running.
Look at the way the flames are shooting from the seams.
The rivets will hold. They've got to hold.
Don't climb on top, Dr. Humphreys. Don't do it.
Don't worry about me. Just keep that fire going.
Pressure, 76 pounds.
Watch your pressure, Rogers.
Open pressure valve. Down 1 pound.
Are you all right up there, Bob? Watch out for that flame.
I'm okay. Okay. He'll never stop those seam leaks.
Let's get out of here. She's going to blow.
There we are. She's not going to blow. She's holding. He's stopping the leaks.
Are your hands awfully burnt, Dad?
Oh, they're not so bad, Claude.
Do you think you'll be able to hold your fishing pole?
Sure.
Well, I packed some sandwiches. Chicken, Swiss cheese, there's cake, pickles. Enough to get you both good and sick.
Bob!
Ah, here comes Dr. Burton.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gee whiz. Every time we get started, something turns up.
Claude, listen to me. No matter what happens, remember, we're going fishing.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Morning, Dr. Burton.
Bob, I had to come out and give you the news. We've just checked the runoff. What do you think the gasoline ran?
Oh, with a good break, 25%?
You're way off.
Oh.
Less?
More. We ran a full 35%.
35%?
We doubled the old yield. Doubled the yield. Twice as much gasoline from every barrel of crude. Bob, that's as though overnight we made two oil wells sprout where just one was standing before.
Oh, that's fine. Fine.
Oh, wonderful, Bob.
Thank you, dear.
Now, when we go back to the plant, we've got to get started. We want new stills made. We'll have to call in engineers, arrange a production schedule. What's that you got there, Claude?
A fishing pole.
Oh. Fish biting?
Yep. Real good.
You don't say.
Caught a mess by myself yesterday.
Hmm. Claude?
Yes, Dr. Burton?
Got another pole?
Yes, sir.
Good. Mrs. Humphreys, will you be good enough to call my office? Tell them I won't be back.
Oh.
If they ask why, just say that Dr. Burton and Dr. Humphreys are in conference. Can't be disturbed.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. William Burton, who is here in the theater with us tonight, and Dr. Robert Humphreys, who is listening to our broadcast, have seen great changes come to the oil industry in the 40 years since those tense, dramatic days when they perfected the first successful oil cracking process at the plant of Standard Oil at Whiting, Indiana, and assured a constant flow of gasoline to power the wheels of America. Their achievement is typical of the many scientists and engineers in America's great petroleum industry who have made tremendous strides in the improvement and development of many new processes which have been patented. This is Oil Progress Week. The oil industry has come a long way since its early days, from stagecoaches toiling their dusty way across the country in a month to oil-powered trains that make the trip in 65 hours, from horse-powered agriculture to modern farms with tractors, from the Surrey with a fringe on top to jet planes flying faster than the speed of sound. Today, nearly 4 million American homes are centrally heated by oil burners, while 5 million more use oil space heaters. There are more service stations than there are post offices or drugstores. And behind the servicemen, behind the dealers who serve you with more than 1,000 petroleum products, are 400 refineries, 150,000 miles of pipeline, 500 tankers, 2,400 barges, 100,000 railroad tank cars,
and 140,000 tank trucks. The oil companies now supply 5.5 million barrels of oil every day. Yet, known reserves of petroleum, thanks to vigilant exploration, are higher today than ever before. The oil business is big business because it has a big job to do for a big country. At the same time, it is one of the most competitive businesses known. You buy the brand of gasoline that works best in your car. You buy your fuel oil from the dealer who gives you the best service. Each dealer competes for every purchase you make. This free competition brings you greater value than ever in today's petroleum products. This is Cy Harris reminding you to join us next week when the star of the DuPont Cavalcade will be Margaret O'Brien. Our story, Juliet in Pigtails, tells of a little girl and her big dream and how it all came true, and thereby America has a new dramatic star. Be sure to listen. Tonight's DuPont play, Wizards of Whiting, starring Lee Bowman as Dr. Humphreys and Ralph Bellamy as Dr. Burton, was written by Irv Tunick. Music was composed by Arden Cornwell and conducted by Donald Voorhees. The program was directed by John Zoller.
Don't forget, next week, Margaret O'Brien on the DuPont Cavalcade of America, which comes to you from the Belasco Theater in New York and is sponsored by the DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware, makers of better things for better living through chemistry.
The Cavalcade of America, on Tuned to Yesterday from October 17, 1950 on NBC. Bringing to a close this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden years. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levenier. Thanks for listening.